Hi everyone, yes, my name's Maisie. I'm in the third year of my PhD at Manchester in the sociology of human-animal relationships, as Saskia said, and I study people who study animals. So my ethnographic research looks at different models of animal behaviour expertise, and I'm interested in the different ideas about animal mind, animal subjectivity, and the human-animal relationship that are embedded in those expertises. And of how tensions between idea of human and non-human, self and other, subject and object, get played out in those methodologies. So in this talk, I'm going to be exploring how the emotional life of humans and horses was compared and contrasted at one of my research sites, where the teaching of horse and herd behaviour formed part of the activities at an equine-assisted personal development site. I'm particularly interested here in the role that the idea of horses as prey animals played in shaping people's interpretations of horse emotions and also of human emotional life. In equine-assisted personal development, all work with horses happens from the ground, so there's no riding involved. It shares some similarities with equine-assisted therapy, but it's not the same. It doesn't require the presence of a trained psychotherapist, for example. Instead, the aim is to gain insights into one's own more everyday behaviour patterns developing skills like self-awareness, communication skills, relaxation techniques, mindfulness, and so on. So, in this talk, I'm going to argue that the idea of horses as prey animals plays a very important role in shaping public understandings of horse emotions in this relatively new and emerging form of horse-human interaction. In particular, I'll argue that prey animal emotions in this site did not signify weakness and deficiency vis-a-vis the human, but a certain kind of epistemic authority and even moral virtue. I'll begin by briefly explaining how viewing horse behaviour through a lens of prey-predator relations has become popularised, and where and why it has come in for critique. I'll then introduce the field site, and I'll explore two ways in which the prey-animal paradigm was used to explain horse emotions. And finally, I'll return to the critique and compare my findings. So the theory that an animal's trophic relations, their position in the food chain, shaped social behaviours began to become popular in the 1970s, when ethologists became interested in how living in a social group might be of evolutionary benefit to animals and helping share the share the burden of remaining vigilant for predators and so forth. But the idea of predator-prey relations as a way to explain their interactions with humans has become particularly common discourse in some traditions of natural horsemanship. So natural horsemanship is a way of training horse and rider, primarily originating in the cowboy traditions of the Western United States. It claims to be based on observation of the social dynamics of wild herds, and claims to treat the horse with more kindness and more sensitivity towards its natural instincts. Pat Pirelli argues that, in fact, the human is the horse's biological enemy. And that horses are predisposed to fear humans because we share certain markers with other predators. He says, like eyes in the front of our head, and even a certain inattentiveness to our surroundings and a certain narrowness of focus. Humans, he says, need to learn to act like a partner, not a predator. And that means becoming more aware and understanding that certain behaviours are more likely to be caused by fear than by mischief or aggression on the part of the horse. And so through natural horsemanship, participants learn to interact differently with horses to find a relationship between biological predator and prey. And natural horsemanship has come in for critique from a number of quarters, but sociologists Linda Burke and Kerry Brandt have criticised its prey-animal discourse for what they perceive to be its gendered overtones. The horse is passively acted upon by emotional instincts that it can't control, needing help to think through and override those instincts. In contrast, the human, often epitomised by the highly stylized masculinity of the cowboy, is still metaphorically figured as the active predator in these interactions. So they say, horses as potential prey then become figured at least partly as feminine, as needing help to think through their emotional flight response. Moreover, natural horsemanship advocates speak passionately of the need to learn to speak horse, hinting at a desire to transform oneself into horse just as the hunters perceive prey. In this way, horses and women are figured similarly. The horse is at the mercy of its own instincts, its essential nature, and the human can help the horse override its instincts so that the two can participate in a goal-orientated relationship. At the heart of this community is the cowboy, who, while appearing gentle and caring, is still the commander of the beast. However, the way that horses as prey animals was, the way that this idea was mobilised in equine-assisted personal development talk, I suggest was somewhat different. Here it plays a role in the scientific authorisation of horses' social and emotional sensitivity and responsiveness. The site at which I was researching, I'm calling Equine Instinct, and it was owned and run by a sole facilitator called Erin, and this is a picture from the site. The horses obligingly galloped for me on the last day, so I could get that photo. And Erin has a herd of 14 horses. They live outside all year round. They are never ridden anymore. And the work has two aims, learning about horses and learning about yourself. And I spent approximately a month conducting multi-species ethnography at that site, a very blissful month, I have to say, taking part in retreats and conducting 13 interviews with the small number of participants that were on each retreat. So I'll briefly explain a typical activity at Equine Instinct. Now, retreats generally involve a three-day process. The last day is spent out with a herd, interacting freely with the horses and learning more about horse ethology and behaviour. But the first 2 days typically take place in an enclosed arena, as you can see here. So you are asked to choose both your horse and your intention for that session. And both horse and human are then released into the arena, and Erin and the other participants will sit back behind a fence and watch. And there's deliberately no task and no instructions. So the person can approach the horse if they wish or not. And Erin looks for how that person meets the challenges of that interaction and what shifts in the emotions of horse and human take place. So she'll come in at various points with questions for the clients. So how do you feel about what's playing out? And is that reflective for you in your own life? And so on and so forth. But on the first day, Erin makes clear that her work, like most other EAPD work, is grounded in the prey animal model, and she distributes this handout. So, as you can see, horses' prey animal ontology is used to explain why horses live in a present moment state. Is this a thing? Yes, it is. Live in a present moment state, highly attentive to and absorbed in the moment. It's also linked to the ability to read and instantly respond to people's feeling state and intent, because they need to be able to sense and smell changes in their environment in an instant. Horses are thus in response all the time, and that's why they can help us learn and develop ourselves. So in the next section, I'll explore how horses' emotional ontology as prey animals was understood. And what does this say about what Burke and Brandt called the feminization of the horse, their characterization as emotional, irrational, and helpless? So first of all, throughout the retreats, horses were understood to be what I'm calling emotional natives. So emotion is the language that they speak. And they speak it with a greater embodied sophistication than that of humans. The rationale of the arena exercise was that as prey animals, they were not only highly attuned to the affective registers of others, but even to emotions which were invisible to the facilitator, and perhaps even those which were not acknowledged by the client themselves. In this way, the facilitation worked through what Erin called horse's truth. It was ultimately the horse that had the most authority and the most insights into the human-animal interaction in that space. So, but when the horse makes a choice, the person might be asked, what was going on for you just before the horse turned away? And in this sense, Erin would say, the horse sees you for who you really are in that moment. And the prize in this scenario is to find a connection with the horse and Connection was initially conceived of as touch, connection through touch and stroking, but as people progress through the retreats and into the advanced retreats, it's conceived somewhat differently as a more intangible and effective emotional kind of becoming animal in that sense, often described in a very emotionally intense way by the participants. And the idea of horses as emotional experts was usually readily taken on by the participants. And the group narrative around this scenario sometimes became one in which the horse became insightful to the point of all-knowing. And this all-knowingness became associated with empathy and protection. So as Kathy says, over the last month or so, I had quite a lot going on in my life relating to my children and possible sense of loss, I don't know. And whether he was picking up on that, I think possibly I thought he was, kind of on a very deep level. Maybe it was emotional, some kind of connection of empathy. It felt very loving, actually, very loving. And Kathy's reference to a very deep level here is significant because this emotional literacy and fluency was conceived of spatially as well as epistemologically. So Erin, and in turn the participants, often spoke of horses as communicating and receiving information on a different level to that of humans, as down in their bodies rather than up in their heads. And Teresa, a participant, says, well, that's where horses are. They're not in their heads, but in their senses, feelings, body language. It's all to do with their safety. They've got to keep an eye on the environment the entire time to be aware of what's going on. So they're listening on a different level to us. And I say, do you think this work could be done with another animal? And she says, I mean, I know you can get therapy dogs, but I think the difference between dogs and horses is that the horse is a prey animal. So that shifts the amount of information the horse will be getting because they need to stay safe themselves. A dog doesn't need to do that. And this resonant, embodied, and effective relationship to the environment was often talked about in contradistinction to the human experience. So humans were often talked about as disconnected from their bodies and emotions. We live in our heads up here, so she would often go, we're up here, and tap her head. Our lives dominated by a mind that was conceived of as loud and busy, wrapped up in narrating our life instead of fully living our experience in the present moment. As Hannah says, I think we're so much in our sort of prefrontal cortex sense of experiencing life in the world, even emotionally and physically. And I think horses read us, understand us in a different way. And I think they can maybe help connect us to those parts of ourselves that we've become a bit dislocated from. And I think that's partly to do with their flight nature. And in their interactions with horses, participants sometimes reflected on times when they had gone into their heads and horses responded negatively. And this caused them to reflect on the ways in which they tended to ignore or distract themselves from their emotions in everyday life, through social media, through excessive work, or through over-attention to the needs of others. So rather than this prey animality making horses irrational and helpless, the embodied emotional expertise it generates here is a source of power, epistemological authority, and moral virtue, to be emulated by learning exercises that helped us to get out of our heads and into our bodies. And there we could learn to find these underlying half-conscious states that we were bringing into the arena with the horse, and do the work to allow us to connect with the horse more fully. And horses, it was felt, could not connect with you in an emotional, in a cognitive state or a cognitive frame of mind. Erin sometimes described it almost as a kind of distortion, almost like a kind of voice distortion, that the horse just simply couldn't read you, and that they needed to feel you present in their body before they could understand who you were and what you were about. So in that sense, it's the cognitive busy mind which is the threat, which is effectively the predator in this scenario. And secondly, horses were conceived as particularly emotionally expressive and therefore more content. Now, the notion of human misfortune in relation to animals has an ancient history. But more recently, contemporary somatic psychotherapists have taken up much the same theme, but increasingly through a predator-prey lens, and maybe some people know more about this than I would. But Erin says some of her influences are somatic psychotherapists working in trauma, such as Peter Levine. So Levine theorizes that human trauma is, in fact, a thwarted survival instinct, something that results in the buildup of suppressed emotion, and that this is actually caused by humans' evolutionary location between predator and prey. So the fight, flight, freeze instinct, he says, was inherent to hunter-gatherers, but becomes thwarted by the more cognitive, planning, rational predator instinct of more settled communities that makes us hesitate and analyze and plan and not always immediately discharge that fearful energy. This wisdom of the prey was not rendered quite so explicitly at Equine Instinct. However, throughout the retreats, there was a sense that horses were far more emotionally healthy as a result of processing their emotions immediately and physically. So, for example, on the last day in the field with the herd, and this is us, that's me, in the herd with the horses, we were frequently encouraged to notice how horses processed their emotions. We were told about how the horse's biology was primed for instant flight, and how they engaged in cycles of grazing and rest so they could always be ready to go, and the way that their legs lock to be able to sleep standing up. We learned too how the spread of emotion through a herd was like catching a wave so that everybody would move at the same time. And in addition, we were encouraged to observe how horses released energy physically in more everyday ways. So Erin would draw attention to releasing behavior like licking and chewing. For example, after a horse had approached us and then relaxed and released in our presence. She would point out the way that horses of a higher herd status put pressure on those of a lower herd status by moving them on from their grazing hatch. And the horse usually responded, she said, by releasing, by moving themselves on and accepting the authority of the higher status herd member. And these observations often led to discussions about the harmony that the horses appeared to have in the herd as a result of releasing these emotions, able to move on and live life peacefully in the herd as a result of releasing these emotions and able to stay in a present moment state without the continual running commentary of an over-analytic mind. And again, this was held up as a moral exemplar. So Kathy says, I do think horses are teachers. I mean, they've really got a lot to teach us about how we deal with stress. I mean, the whole idea of animals is shaking off stress, you know. They don't hold it in their bodies. They will get rid of it. They'll discharge it. We don't do that generally. It will all kind of build up. So you'll then probably go into a whole narrative of, you know, how badly you've been treated. So our minds construct this story about what might have happened and might not, what might not have happened, and we then hang on to that. And Lila says, I thought they suffer like we do, but they don't internalize a lot, they just deal with it. Well, they don't bear grudges, do they? They just go, oh, all right, I'll not keep eating here then. You know, it's not gonna get you back. Do you see what I mean? They're just, somebody will barge somebody and they'll go, oh, all right, no, no, no. I just love that. So in this way, horses' willingness to embrace the fear of being prey, to not hesitate in the face of danger, and to fully and physically express and release that emotion granted them both safety, emotional health, and social harmony. So to summarise, the story of predator-prey relations that we have here at Equine Instinct in equine-assisted personal development is, I think, a very different one to that described in Burke and Brandt's analysis of natural horsemanship cultures. Instead of the horse needing help to process and manage its emotions more rationally, here the horse's emotional literacy and expressivity gives it an authority and expertise in the arena over and above that of the human facilitator. Their ability to be in their bodies rather than up in their heads was understood to be a moral virtue because they avoid the build-up of trauma and resentful relationships with others caused by an over-analytic mind, by cognitive epistemologies. Being a horse here is to model a way of being in the world that is emotionally and physically expressive, arguably culturally feminine, and thus psychologically healthy. And I think that the use of the predator-prey model in EAPD demonstrates, first of all, the social power of evolutionary explanations of behaviour, and the complex ways in which it can become elaborated and extended into contemporary cultural preoccupations. So few would doubt that horses are indeed prey animals, and that this has to some degree shaped their social behaviour. But as we've seen, the concept does an awful lot of explanatory work. Is connected to multiple emerging trends like the mindfulness movement, like somatic psychotherapy, and even perhaps human rewilding or primitivist movements. And therefore, I think deserves closer attention from multi-species ethnographers. Ethnography helped me understand where these explanations were more or less convincing, and where they held more or less ethical potential for human-horse relations. I suggest that EAPD is one example of where I think animals are becoming enrolled, for better or for worse, into notions of a recoverable, more authentic human self of the distant past. In this sense, to misquote the film of Jungle Book, humans seem willing to trade the power of man's red flower of fire for the gift of something else, the present moment state of prey animals. Thank you.